The third Monday in January every year is a U.S. federal holiday, Martin Luther King Jr. Day. It's January 21st this year, and as always, Bates College will cancel classes for the day and will instead hold events in observance of the holiday. I'm Michael Sargent, and I'm pleased to be one of the co-chairs of this year's planning committee for the day. We're excited about everything happening that day as well as other days that week. One important event will be the Monday morning keynote address by Barbara Ransby, distinguished professor of African American Studies, Gender and Women's Studies, and History at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She's the author of such books as Ella Baker and the Black Freedom Movement, A Radical Democratic Vision, as well as Making All Black Lives Matter, Reimagining Freedom in the 21st Century. She's also served as a recent president of the National Women's Studies Association. And she's coming to Bates. I recently had a chance to talk with Professor Ransby about topics related to her upcoming keynote address, and here's the bulk of our conversation. Personally, since I've been attending these MLK Day events at Bates and thinking about Martin Luther King Jr., I think that he is, I would say, he was a heroic man, meaning that as a man and thus a human being, he was fallible and he was flawed, but he did do heroic things. But for all of that heroism, I think that there is danger, even on MLK Day, in hero worship. I wonder what your thoughts are on those issues.
Well, I certainly agree with that. A lot of my own scholarship and activism has been based on the notion that we really need to develop more egalitarian and democratic models of leadership and organizing. And I think that's one of the lessons from Ella Baker's example, which is a person I spent a lot of time writing about many years ago and who worked closely with Dr. King. But I also think it's sometimes we place a burden on Dr. King's legacy that even he would not have appreciated. That is, you know, this sort of singular great man version of the civil rights movement. And I think King himself understood that while he took sacrifices and made contributions, that it really, you know, was the work of many other people who made the movement possible and made his greatness possible. So, I think one of the lessons from Black Lives Matter movement now is that, model the leadership that really empower grassroots people is really what's more sustainable. I think we saw in the 1960s a number of heroic figures like Dr. King, Malcolm X, and others who were assassinated, others who changed political course. And, you know, that points to the fragility of a certain model of leadership, a kind of messianic kind of leadership. And so, you know, what my own scholarship and practice has been very much about is a different approach. It's, I think, a feminist approach, it's a grassroots approach, but it's also not an approach that Dr. King would have been hostile to at all. Another example that comes to mind is his Nobel speech, his acceptance speech when he received the Nobel Peace Prize, in which he talked about himself and others being cast as sort of the pilot on an airplane of justice, and he talks about remembering the ground crew without whom, you know, our journey would not have been possible. So, you know, there are many eloquent metaphors that he uses to talk about grassroots organizers and the masses of ordinary people who participated in what we now term the civil rights movement. You know, Ella Baker even more pointedly, you know, argued that it wasn't Martin that made the movement, but the movement that made Martin. And she also reminded us that, you know, leaders who teach following as the only way of fighting have done a disservice. And so I think both from the words of King and Ella Baker, you know, there's a call to action for ordinary people to not look for the next Martin Luther King, but to really look for, you know, the strength and capacity within our own communities for freedom struggles and for social justice campaigns.
For those who are not already familiar with Ella Baker, what would you say briefly by way of introduction to her?
Well, you know, Ella Baker, I think she's more widely known now than certainly when I began my research on her, you know, a decade and a half ago. But, you know, Ella Baker was someone born in 1903 and died on her birthday in 1986 and was pretty much active in the struggle for racial and social justice throughout her life. She was active as an organizer in the 1930s in Harlem. She worked with the NAACP in the 1940s, worked alongside W.B. Du Bois and Thurgood Marshall, and later Dr. Martin Luther King. And she's probably best known as the founder and mentor to the young people in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, who, of course, you know, launched the desegregation sit-ins and Freedom Rides and Freedom Summer in 1964. Ella Baker had a particular approach to organizing and to leadership. She was, you know, very much emphasized bringing the most marginal sectors of any community to the center of social justice organizing. And she also felt like ordinary people had the power to determine the priorities within their communities and to lead justice campaigns and freedom campaigns in those communities. So she did not subscribe to the charismatic, hierarchical kind of leadership model, and she was very critical of that model as it appeared in the civil rights movement, in the black church, and in other places. You know, she was someone who mentored a whole generation of activists, really two generations of activists, and is, you know, not as well known as she should be.
So it sounds as if it would be reasonable to predict that were she alive today, she would embrace the Black Lives Matter movement.
I think she would. I think Ella Baker was a very sharp thinker and analyst as well. You know, sometimes when we talk about women in social justice campaigns, we have these kind of maternal images. You know, they just loved everybody and supported everybody. And, you know, she was a real critical thinker. She was like, this approach was, you know, makes sense and this approach doesn't. And here's what we're fighting for. So she was that kind of intellectual leader as well as tactical leader. So I think she would support the thrust of the Black Lives Matter movement and the movement for Black Lives. And I think she would also have some suggestions and some critiques that she would offer, as we would expect her to do.
Does one in particular come to mind?
You know, this movement, this generation of movement activists have been able to organize, some of them full-time, because of foundation support and funding that has come from various sources. And I think Ella Baker might have a word of caution about that. She would probably encourage people to figure out funding strategies that relied much more on the communities that those movements are serving rather than, you know, philanthropic interests. I think she probably would also warn against any hints of celebrity, which creep into every movement and have crept into this one, even though certainly, you know, a lot of conscientious folks have resisted that.
Is there a particular reason that at this moment in history you think it's important on MLK Day to talk about Ella Baker?
Many reasons. I mean, I like to say I bring Ella Baker with me wherever I go. she's a good person to have on your shoulder in, you know, in spirit to remind us of how to ground ourselves. So I think the lessons of Ella Baker are very important now, not only for her teachings about leadership and accountability to grassroots communities, but also, you know, she was very much about systemic change. You know, she said, we really, you know, need to look at the entire system of injustice and not just one small part of it. So she looked at racism. She looked at sexism. She looked at war and empire. She was a critic of capitalism. So, so she really invites us to have a holistic approach to social change. And I think that, is something that's missing in some of the work, you know, that we can easily become fragmented or single issue, focused in our organizing. And it's hard to hold a very large set of issues in a coalition or larger movement formation, but I think that's the challenge that Ella Baker would have us take up. You know, I argue in the book that I've written about the Black Lives Matter movement and in a number of articles that it's important that we see not only the race politics, but the class politics. And when we look at issues of police violence in the Black community, we're not all impacted equally. They're not college professors and lawyers and doctors who are the primary victims of police violence and state violence in this period. And in fact, we've seen some members of the Black community achieve enormous success and really wield real power. That said, poor and working class Black folks, people like Eric Garner and Tamir Rice's family and Michael Brown's family and others, you know, are economically vulnerable and racially vulnerable. And so understanding that intersection, if you will, between race and class, I think is a real challenge and a lesson of the Black Lives Matter movement. The movement has focused not on sort of the more respectable, in quotes, members of the African-American community, but those people that in some ways the economic system has seen as disposable or superfluous. If we think of someone like Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge, who was killed in an arrest effort by local police there, what was his crime? He was selling CDs out of the back of his car.
Right.
Or Eric Garner, who was strangled on Staten Island, he was selling loose cigarettes to help support his family. So in both of those cases, those men were functioning in the informal economy. They were poor and working class people. And that is as much a part of their profile and their vulnerability as the fact that they were Black men. And the movement has not de-emphasized their class status, but really pointed to the need for economic reform and economic justice at the same time that it has demanded racial justice.
I was recently speaking to Dan Kaufman, who's the author of the book The Fall of Wisconsin, which traces the political history of Wisconsin from relatively progressive roots to the Scott Walker era, so something other than progressive. And
understatement.
Yeah. And one of the things that came out of my conversation with Kaufman was that he saw the labor movement as a place where there's a real potential for transracial activism. And I wonder if you're optimistic that Black Lives Matter could potentially connect with organized labor, or perhaps there are ways in which they already have that you can describe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I have a number of friends who are labor organizers, union organizers, and I really, you know, feel we have to support organized labor, but I also think we have to expand our notion of labor organizing. You know, there are very large unions that fought for workers' rights over many years and in some ways become somewhat distant from some of the community struggles that exist. And then there's new forms of labor organizations like worker centers, you know, around the country that have sprung up, that have attempted to organize undocumented workers, temporary workers, seasonal workers, et cetera, and groups like the National Domestic Workers Alliance, which has done really important labor organizing around domestic workers' bill of rights and so forth. So these are kind of non-traditional labor organizations. I just want to make sure, you know, they're in the mix when we talk about labor and workers' issues. That said, Movement for Black Lives has worked most notably with SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, around the Fight for 15, which involves a lot of Black and brown workers who are in that very low pay category. And you know, the demand has been for $15 an hour in a union. And there have been massive demonstrations in Chicago and elsewhere around that, and Black Lives Matter activists have been very involved, both Black Lives Matter Global Network as an organization, Black Youth Project 100, which is another organization that is under the umbrella of Black Lives Matter and the Movement for Black Lives. Also, here in Chicago, which is where I live and work. Chicago Teachers Union has been a great ally of the Movement for Black Lives and has supported many of the campaigns that activists here have been involved in around police violence. So I think there are already some kernels of connections, some building blocks that are there. I think we all need to do more. I mean, labor is under assault, you know, with the most recent Supreme Court decision in the Janus case and so forth. I think, you know, public sector unions are vulnerable, but all unions are vulnerable. I think it's a hostile environment in many respects. And so both people who are in the gig economy, people who are in organized labor, people who are, you know, in the process of organizing. We just had a strike here of the first charter school strike ever in the country here in Chicago. So groups that we, you know, have seen as outside of the sphere of organized labor coming into that sphere, and then people, you know, as I said before, pioneering new forms of labor and worker organization. So all of that, I think, is good and needed, and I think, you know, the challenge is to connect the dots, and that's always our challenge, you know, to line up where these movements can be connected.
Given that the theme of MLK Day this year, as well as your title, refers to intersectionality, for the benefit of listeners who are not familiar with that term, how would you briefly acquaint them with that term?
Mm-hmm. I think I'd tell them to come to the talk. But no, I'll say more than that. You know, Audre Lorde, the great Black lesbian organizer who, you know, died a number of years ago, she had a quote where she said, you know, we cannot build single issue movements because we don't live single issue lives. And I think that's a great entree to intersectionality, because basically the idea is that we all have multiple identities. That's one part of the answer. So one is not just a woman, or, you know, just a LGBTQ person, or just a Black person or a Latinx person. Many of us have multiple, all of us have multiple identities. The second point, though, is not just about individual identity, but about systems. You know, that there are systems of oppression that intersect and reinforce each other. Most notably, you know, racism, sexism, and patriarchy, capitalism, and class inequality. But all these systems, you know, intersect and build upon each other in very, very intricate and intimate ways. And in order to really move toward a more just society, we need to have a holistic approach to combating injustice that includes multiple communities and targets multiple systems of oppression. So that is it in a nutshell. I certainly look forward to having a more in-depth discussion when I visit Bates in January.
The keynote session begins at 9 a.m. on Monday, January 21st in the Peter J. Gomes Chapel at 275 College Street in Lewiston, Maine, on the Bates campus. Professor Ransby's address is titled Intersectional Feminist Praxis and the Black Freedom Movement from Ella Baker to Black Lives Matter. For more information on all the events, go to www.bates.edu/MLK. I want to thank Professor Ransby for taking the time to talk with me. I also want to credit Rashad Parker for the audio of the protest from Ferguson, Missouri, and I want to thank all the other members of the MLK Day Planning Committee. The day couldn't happen without everyone in that group. Finally, this episode was edited in the digital media studios at Bates College.